KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I think almost any book that's well done, that draws you into the characters' lives, which are almost by definition different from your own, can do that. "Whenever I am troubled," said the librarian, "I think about the Dewey Decimal System."
I enjoy that intro. And I do look forward to talking to Nancy Pearl again, but I'm pretty darn sure that must have been a mistake. We had a lot of running around and not technical problems with our machinery, and you don't really need to hear this, I know.
I'm ready to talk Dewey Decimal, if that's where you want to go.
Oh, yes, let's do take two. Let's try that again.
I'm not worried about this blocking the project, but I am worried about it being one more thing that delays and impedes and just frankly makes everybody's life harder than it has to be.
Each year the great pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch that he thinks is the most sincere. He's got to pick this one. He's got to.
It's got pastrami with Russian dressing, another thing that just, you know, isn't out there enough. Super delicious, old school taste with a big hunk of coleslaw on rye. It's a delicious sandwich. Really fun.
That's Sarah Dickerman talking about sandwiches today on Weekday. We're going to talk to her a little more about food because you may remember we are gearing up to get our 16 sandwiches that say Seattle, and then we're going to have a taste-off. And then we're going to award an award to the best sandwich. We're also going to hear what happened to the child actors of The Great Pumpkin. And we're going to start with a look at the arena project, voted on by both the county and city councils, a memorandum of understanding passed. But then the longshoremen's are talking about filing a lawsuit to block that over an environmental impact statement issue. Dal Constantine is the King County executive. He's going to take that up with it. Good to see you again, sir.
Well, it's great to be here with Dewey Decimal Day, coleslaw, pumpkins. I mean, soup to nuts.
And don't forget at 10:18. It's 10:18 on 10:18.
Oh,
emergency 18 preparedness day.
We are going to duck and cover at 10:18
to remind people about emergency preparedness.
How long do we have to be
under the table? I don't know. We didn't ask. May I ask something totally off topic first?
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Why not? I often ask you what you're listening to in your new music, but I was excited to see the Pete Townsend biography come out.
Yeah.
And you too, huh?
Yeah, I ordered it. It arrived in the mail. I'm excited to dig into it. Pete wrote an autobiography, and it is, by all accounts, fascinating and really comprehensive. And he did this great round of TV interviews on ridiculous U.S. TV shows like The View last week, which got a chance to catch.
I saw him on The Daily Show. He was pretty funny on The Daily Show because they actually had a reasonable conversation at some point.
It was, well, you know, it depends on the kind of caliber of the interviewer, I think.
I think that's exciting. It would be great if he was touring. I don't think that I don't know if he's coming to the lower echelons of media, though.
Exactly. He's been doing a lot of media out of New York, book signings, did a big deal at the library and at Barnes & Noble. But with Roger Daltrey, he's touring as The Who in some major venues, not including Seattle so far. But we bought tickets to see them in Glendale, Arizona. The only reason I'd ever go to Glendale, Arizona.
Oh, so you're going to see them on this tour?
That's where I could get front row center. So that's where
I'm going. Have you ever seen them before?
Many, many times.
Many times?
Yeah.
I've never seen The Who.
Big venues, small venues.
You saw them in some small venues?
I saw them. This is great. So a charity fundraiser at the House of Blues in Chicago with Pearl Jam opening. It was amazing.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. Vetter got me a signed an autographed poster from himself and Townsend, which is on the wall of my county executive office.
However, before you were a county executive, this was all through your connections as a former KCMU DJ and lover of local music.
This is just through being a zealous follower of music.
Yeah, yeah.
Wandering around the country, seeing old men play rock and roll.
Well, you said you hadn't read the Keith Richards biography.
I have not, although I heard it was fantastic. And I understand he was one of my fellow Boy Scouts as well. That was one key takeaway from the book.
I just can't see. I see Keith Richards as he was the Boy Scout that was
the troublemaker.
Yeah, yeah. Or else never really, you know, getting any merit badges, but always wanting to learn how to build certain things or, you know, start certain fires, things like that.
Scouting, you know, I know the scouts are having some problems now. Scouting was a great experience. I was over in West Seattle, and my troop had fascinating characters in it who I see all the time. So Scott Carsberg, who's one of Seattle's top chefs, he has a restaurant, Bisotto, which he's talking about closing, going on hiatus after over two decades. He's sort of an enfant terrible of chefs, and he was an Eagle Scout in my troop.
Is that right?
Right along with me. We used to go on hikes. And
were you an Eagle Scout?
Yeah.
You went all the way?
And actually, Scotty Carsberg's home ec teacher was my mom at Madison Junior High. So
see, that's
there's,
why
a little, there's a fun fact to know and tell.
That's why we live in a small town.
Yeah.
Because you could talk about where did you go for your extensive outdoor experience as a scout? Where did you go to the Cascades?
We had a very active troop. So we were hiking in the Cascades a lot. We did a lengthy ocean hike every summer. We did a hike like from Stevens Pass to Snoqualmie Pass.
And you guys did that hike?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you believe it? I did
that
hike.
That's a good hike.
It was a really good experience. I think that scouting should be open to all.
It shouldn't be Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts. It should be scouts.
The scouting experience is something that can help everyone. And the fact that Boy Scouts of America still insist on excluding gay kids, insist on excluding atheist kids is, I think, really unfortunate.
Scouting was a great I did not make it all the way, however, to Eagle Scout, but I am impressed that you did. But I did go to Philmont Scout Ranch. Did you go there?
I did not. Wow.
That's where I first saw a bear.
Really?
Yeah, because I lived in Illinois. You know, we saw bears in zoos.
I'm sure your listeners are fascinated by it.
All right. I'm sorry. I apologize. Unless people were enjoying it, in which case we could continue. All right. You got the Memorandum of Understanding approved by the council and by the county council and the city council. The longshoremen's are suing, and they're saying that this environmental impact statement process is, I will now put words in their mouth, bogus, because you have already decided on the site in Sodo, even though you do have one other site yet to be named that will be considered. Why aren't they right? Why isn't this bogus? You have already concluded that this is going to be where it's built. Now you're going to do the EIS on it.
Well, the county and the city have a legal obligation to carry out the full State Environmental Policy Act review. In addition to that, the Memorandum of Understanding makes it absolutely clear that the city and county will not decide whether to proceed until an EIS has been completed. The SEPA review, and we've been very specific about this in the Memorandum of Understanding, has to look at alternative sites, traffic impacts, freight mobility, port operations, and the range of mitigation that may be needed. Fortunately, the agreements now include $40 million that will help with traffic, freight, and pedestrian mitigation. But there's no action alternative as well. So I don't agree. I'm not going to get into the legal arguments, but I don't agree with the proposition that SEPA is somehow being short-circuited by this. I also don't agree with the notion that this arena is a threat to maritime jobs. Quite the opposite. The prosperity as well as the direct revenue for transportation improvements will help deal with problems that we don't have the resources to deal with now. With the movement of freight, with the movement of commuters, and with pedestrian and bike improvements. So I understand that there are a lot of challenges to the future viability of our deep water port, from the Panama Canal to competition from local ports to existing transportation challenges. This arena is not among the significant challenges to our port future.
Remind me, where does that $40 million for the mitigation coming from?
So that comes from funds that are raised through taxes within the arena deal, and it requires a certain amount of greater risk on the part of Mr. Hansen. And it also requires the city and county to step up and engage in the planning and a joint allocation of that money. So it will be generated by the arena. It is funding that goes to deal with problems that we don't have the money to deal with now. And if you go down to the Soto area in the middle of the day, when, by the way, there are no basketball or hockey games happening, you see the traffic tie-ups that are a real genuine concern for all of us who care about having that that port economy continue here.
How does that work then? The money has to be paid up front by city and county out of general fund, and then it's reimbursed when the arena starts generating revenue?
We added that $40 million infrastructure fund to address the existing issues, and it will be available upfront out of the deal. The fact is that the city and county are being paid back their up to $200 million investment over the course of 30 years out of this. So that's part of the capital that's put out upfront
by
Mr. Hansen.
Oh, by Mr. Hansen.
Investors. And the presumption is that we'll all be paid back to them as well, because they're going to be able to achieve revenues above what's required to pay back the public.
Where will the other in the SEPA process, what other site will be looked at?
I believe there's a east side site that's been the favorite of some folks that they've heard about in the news recently that will likely be looked at. That seems, I think that the assumption is that that's a site that will be looked at. There's no alternative proposal, and there may be other sites that are looked at. I'm not an expert in the SEPA. That's for our lawyers to deal with.
What is a no alternative? What is that?
Just to do nothing, the no action alternative.
Oh, that's always there.
Yeah.
All right, so you're not an expert, but let me ask this question anyways.
Mm-hmm.
How different is this, a site located and then another site offered as an alternative? How different is that from past process? I remember during the run-up to Brightwater, which was a county project, I think there were four or five sites that were looked at during the environmental review process. That seems to be the standard, and this doesn't seem to be the standard. What is your interpretation and memory?
My understanding is that, and the commitment both through the law and through this memorandum of understanding, is that a full SEPA process will be carried out, and that requires the examination of alternatives. And the collection of alternatives to be examined, I'm not able to go into any more depth on. I don't know.
You don't know.
The rest of that.
So it sounds like it's a process that's somewhat left open. I guess the courts will determine if it's left open.
Absolutely.
In this case or
yeah.
Not. Is this going to cost the county and the city money, this lawsuit?
Well, sure, of course. You know, these things cost money, but it's part of our process, our messy process, and it is designed to ensure that things are done right, that all the environmental impacts, and environmental in this case drawn very broadly to include traffic impacts and other issues, are examined and that appropriate mitigation is undertaken for whichever alternative is chosen.
The Longshoremen's Union is bringing this suit or lead on this suit. What conversations have you had with longshoremen?
I haven't really had any conversations with longshoremen, but I believe now our lawyers are going to be conversing with their lawyers.
Well, I ask that in part because, as you said, you continue to say that this is not going to impact and should not have an impact on
right.
The port's ability to do its business, that there are other factors involved.
I think that this has become a bit of a scapegoat for all of the troubles that the port is having.
So, but if you wanting to keep these kinds of jobs in the county, that's why I was wondering if you'd had conversations with longshoremen or longshoremen union leaders because of the other pressures. What are the alternatives for longshoremen?
Well, it's 18 after. We're having an earthquake right
now. No, we're not.
A real earthquake. A fake earthquake.
Because, yes, I'm sorry, we had, yeah, that's right, we were going to mention that. Because the county, I guess is this the whole state that's taking part in this?
I believe it is.
10-18 at 10-18?
I believe it is. And we knew there was a fake earthquake going on because your staff in the booth next door were stomping their feet.
Yeah.
So we have a really robust emergency preparedness system in King County.
Actually, it's nationwide. I should just say that.
Thank you.
It's nationwide and from L.A. up here. And you were saying?
We have a really robust emergency preparedness operation in King County. In fact, this week we convened all of our regional emergency preparedness leaders. I think there are about 150 people at our emergency center on the hilltop in Renton, just down the road from Jimi Hendrix's grave, just for reference sake, and talked to them about the upcoming winter storm season and the improvements we've made this year to our coordination. But the same lessons apply whether it's to a blizzard or a windstorm or earthquake, that we have to have very high level of coordination, that we have to have a lot of opportunity for mutual aid. And I think that each year we're becoming better and better prepared to be able to both deal with the immediate aftermath and recover more quickly from a disaster.
I should say that at 10:18, people were asked to practice the actions, what you have to do in a real earthquake: drop to the ground, take cover beneath a sturdy table, hold on until the shaking stops.
And just for the record, you and I are now right under the table.
We have dropped and covered.
With our microphones.
Back. Where were you at the earthquake that struck in 2001?
I was in the state capitol, which was darn near the epicenter of the whole thing. And the Capitol Dome was making some ungodly noises as it slowly rotated around.
Is that right?
Stone grinding on stone. It sounded like you were inside a drum and the whole thing was going to come down on your head. It was really weird.
I wish somebody had gotten that on tape.
Yeah. It was a strange place to be. I was at home in West Seattle during the 1965 earthquake. And
is that right? You remember that?
Yeah, very well. Yeah, I remember all the cupboards opening and the glassware and dishes pouring out. But this thing in Olympia, that was quite something.
Why, when you said, and I will come back after the break to the question of the arena and some other things, but when you said our preparedness is better, you were looking at winter storms. Of course, the Howard Hanson Dam was a big mm-hmm. concern in the past. That seems to be not a concern anymore.
Yeah, we've fixed that.
What are the big concerns around the county for this winter?
Well, always snowstorms, always flooding. We're every year improving our flood prevention. But we have three major river systems that, by their nature, want to overflow their banks. And so we're constantly on guard for flood events. We're improving because we're working to coordinate all these disparate jurisdictions as well as the nonprofit organizations. And we've been executing memoranda of understanding or agreement with various cities about the provision of mutual aid as well as coordination of decision-making. And we're going to keep working on that because we need to act as one in the case of emergency.
I remember that part of the reason for the surface water management fee
yeah. mm-hmm.
was to help coordinate questions of levees and questions of flooding in outlying areas where development is taking place.
There's the swim fee, which deals with surface water runoff challenges. And then there's a countywide flood district, and that goes directly to the question of the rebuilding or expansion of levees and the challenges we have in a very constrained and developed area, creating enough room for all the water to be able to flow.
Are there any problems with the levees? There were problems with the levees in the past, right? There's a project to work
yeah.
on those at this point?
Yeah, there's a project to work on those.
And money for them.
And money for them. And we had to divert a bunch of money during the Howard Hanson emergency to really beef up temporary measures in the Green River Valley. Those are now being removed now that the dam is sound again. And we're getting back on track doing the methodical work of rebuilding these levees, many of which were just built by farmers back in the day, piling up debris at the edge of the field. Not highly engineered and not terribly sound.
Yeah, I have to ask one more question here on this. Mm-hmm. That was a relationship, the Howard Hanson Dam building, was a relationship building process,
yeah.
I imagine, with the Army Corps of Engineers.
Absolutely.
The Corps has oversight over lots of environmental issues in the county in terms of salmon recovery and habitat mm-hmm. recovery. What improved, what changes, what lines of communication do you think were open that we could see as citizens because of that?
Well, first of all, we got a lot of good work between local jurisdictions in dealing with the federal government through that. But we also got the federal agencies working more closely together, talking about their competing, sometimes completely contradictory requirements for local government. FEMA or the Corps have one approach to levees. The national environmental agencies have a completely different, sometimes contradictory set of requirements. There's now a process being put in place where we will be able to put all of those parties in a room and come up with a holistic approach to levee management and salmon restoration in a river system. And I want us to move forward with the federal government in that. The immediate past colonel of our commander of our Army Corps office here has been hired just recently to head up the Puget Sound Partnership as its director. His name's Anthony Wright, and he has a ton of experience. He's the guy who got the dam fixed. And so he's going to be able to help us start reconciling all these federal requirements and local pots of money to, I hope, be able to have a unified approach to river management.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back with King County Executive Dow Constantine on a weekday.
Good morning. It's 10:25. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle news and information. Last year, the Washington State Supreme Court told lawmakers to fully fund basic K through 12 education. State Superintendent Randy Dorn says that'll cost taxpayers an additional $4.1 billion per year. He's running unopposed for re-election this year. Randy Dorn joins us later today to talk about his goals and vision for the next 4 years. He sits down with KUOW's David Hyde this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs of Seattle University, contemporary professional education in the Jesuit intellectual tradition. All 33 graduate programs and the School of Law host an open house Friday, October 19th. Details at seattleu.edu/events.
We have a mix of clouds and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 54 degrees in the University District. We're expecting a high today of 63. Forecast calls for clouds and a chance of rain later. Tonight, clouds and rain, the low in the low 50s. Cloudy tomorrow with a chance of rain, the high in the mid 50s.
King County Executive Dow Constantine is with us. A few more minutes. If you have questions for Dow Constantine, our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, and you can give us a call. I have some questions as well, but just real quick on the question of longshoremen, but the broader question of the maritime industry. And I understand the county is only tangentially part of this mm-hmm. because you don't have that jurisdiction, but I am curious about, as somebody who deals, you were talking about the awards you gave for small businesses and, mm-hmm. and encouraging small businesses. I am curious about what is the vision for those maritime industries, or I guess, the maritime industries of the future that would incorporate the kind of skill set that longshoremen have in moving freight. Is there anything like that?
Well, I think the question is this. We have these natural assets, this deep water port, and there are other ports on Puget Sound, and the choice of a shipper is not whether they're going to go to Tacoma or Seattle, but whether they're going to go to Puget Sound or to Los Angeles, or whether they're going to go to the West Coast or through the Panama Canal. For our part, we need to be uniting these ports and marketing them as one and coordinating among ourselves about the best way to deal with each customer's needs. And the state's freight mobility plan, the fast corridor plan from years ago, needs to continue to be built out because other regions have done that kind of work. The Alameda Corridor from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach that whisks freight from the waterfront into the middle of LA and then out of town really takes away our one-day sailing advantage to the Far East. So we need to respond. We need to make infrastructure investments in moving the freight to and from the port. These little battles we have and the little fights with Tacoma or other Puget Sound ports are unproductive in the context of the world economy.
Will that $40 million, some of that money that the city had allocated disappeared for went to the Mercer corridor proposal. Some state money disappeared in part because of what happened to our economies. Will that $40 million that's part of this mitigation of the arena go to building out some of the projects?
Well, that will be something that's decided as we look at the results of this SEPA review and the EIS, as well as with conversations with the port about and the city about what is the best way to get freight to and from the docks. And it is there's no single magic answer. You know, people point to the Lander Street overpass that never got built. But in fact, that might not solve many of the problems at all. We got to figure out which things can do the most to move freight quickly to and from the port and right. invest in those.
And yet keep that port business in that area.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me get a couple of questions on that. Let me go to Sharon, who's in Bothell. Siobhan, who's in Bothell. Am I saying that right?
It's Siobhan. It's
Siobhan.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Hi, Siobhan.
Hi. Pardon me, I'm a bit nervous. So my question is, my father has had a business in Pioneer Square for 38 years, and this new stadium for him has kind of become the straw that's broke the camel's back as far as being able to continue doing business in the Pioneer Square area, and I'm wondering how the city council or how is it being addressed, the businesses that are going to have to move? They can't. Clients can't find parking. You know, nobody can find parking. Nobody can walk around down there. People are deciding not to go. And I'm wondering how they're going to plan on handling this.
So the city of Seattle obviously has a keen interest in the health of Pioneer Square. This proposed arena is south of even the Mariners ballpark, a full block south of their parking garage, in fact. So it is not in real close proximity to Pioneer Square. But I understand the concern when there's a large sporting event, like at CenturyLink Field, there can be a lot of folks parking in Pioneer Square who are not customers of the businesses, unless the businesses are bars and restaurants, in which case there's a lot of business. And that has been a challenge really ever since the Mariners opened their ballpark. I don't think that this 18,000-seat arena, as compared to the 40-some-thousand-seat Mariners ballpark or this 60-some-thousand-seat Seahawks Stadium is going to have a particularly large impact on Pioneer Square. But I do think that the city of Seattle has gotten quite serious about figuring out how to rejuvenate Pioneer Square. And we have worked with them on projects like redeveloping the giant vacant north lots of the Kingdom to bring new residents and customers into Pioneer Square.
Well, and that's where the county is involved in construction now. And there's also mm-hmm. the construction that's going on around the bringing down of 99 and the tunnel. Siobhan, I was wondering if I can ask, what is your father's business? Do you want to say?
He's a sole proprietorship. He's a rolfer. He has private clients that come, and he works with injury treatment. But he's been, you know, he moved his office down there in, you know, 1973 when Pioneer Square was quite an eyesore and quite a hard place to have a business. And he's stuck through it. And now he has to schedule every single client around having parking. Basically, if there's an event or two events, he can't book clients. He can't work.
I see. And so he's looking at what he sees. The stadium would be one more event. But isn't he suffering right now because of all the construction and what impact that's had on ability to get around down there?
Construction has not really been an issue. It's more the sheer volume of people and people that are coming out of the stadiums when the stadiums are done, even if it's in the middle of the afternoon on a Saturday. You know, people don't just go down there when there's an event an hour before. They come down. You know, my husband has Sounders tickets for the season, and he goes down 2 and 3 hours before. And so it's, you know, parking is an issue starting at, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon for a 7 o'clock game. So, and there are days where it's like back-to-back things happening in the stadiums. And I've had to block, I do his scheduling, and I've had to block out entire blocks of 4 and 5 days where he can't work.
I see.
Yeah.
All right.
So, and I think that it's an issue for a lot of businesses. You know, LA Bay Bookstore is not there anymore. A lot of the residents who have been there for eons have chosen to go elsewhere because it has become such a stress on your business to be able to have space for your patrons to come and spend money.
All right. Siobhan, I appreciate that. I appreciate that perspective and getting it. That's good. All right, let me grab. Do you want to say something else,
no,
sir?
I appreciate that that her dad has Sounders tickets. We were at the Sounders match yesterday, I guess it was. But the thing that I've always found fascinating is I will have people stop me at Mariners games, for example, to complain to me, or a Husky game at CenturyLink Field, to complain to me about the impact that this basketball arena will have on port jobs. And I think I'm standing in a crowd of 65,000 with someone complaining about the impact that an 18,000-seat arena two blocks away is going to have. I don't understand why they're there then.
Well, aren't they saying this is the additional thing that is
the straw that broke the camel's back?
That's what they're arguing.
You know, the challenge that Pioneer Square has goes way beyond having stadia nearby. It is a challenge of not having enough market rate residential. You have a very small amount, and then there's an awful lot of heavily subsidized housing nearby. And the main strategy, so far as I can discern, is building more market rate housing for downtown workers, for people who are going to walk to shopping or to their doctor's appointments. And it's, you know, part of that is what happens when a city grows up, becomes a place for the people who live in the city or are using transit, and it's harder and harder to get a free parking spot.
By the way, on that note, isn't that the plan for the second phase of the north lot, that it will be another tower with more housing?
Yeah, there's a requirement from the county which owned that property that there be some affordable housing included in it, and some of that is going to be built on site, and some is going to be built the other side of 4th Avenue. I believe, in the International District.
So some is market rate and some is a requirement for affordable housing.
Yeah.
I see. All right. Mark is on Mercer Island. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So, yeah, my question is, and I've heard a lot about the impacts on traffic, in the stadium area itself, but very little, if anything, about the impact on the freeway traffic, particularly I-90 with all the East Siders all coming into the games. It's, I live on Mercer Island, and the traffic, on certain days of the week, actually even at the weekends, can be pretty horrendous when there's, a Huskies game and then a Seahawks game the next day, and then, when the Mariners are overlapping when they're doing well, whenever that happens. But then we're potentially adding two more events, both basketball and, I heard, hockey. And I'm thinking this, putting this stadium at the end of I-90 just seems like insanity. Why would we make the congestion on those freeways worse than they already are, when conceivably they could be put the stadium could be put somewhere else?
What studies are being done on I-90?
Well, there are going to be traffic and transportation studies as part of the environmental process. But the whole reason Chris Hansen was interested in this site in the first place, and the reason I think it makes a lot of sense, is because this is the place with the most transportation and the most transportation modes. In addition to the freeways, there is commuter rail and light rail. There are auto ferries and passenger ferries. There are our rapid ride bus routes and most of the bus routes coming through this area. There are more opportunities for people to get around in more different ways here than anywhere else in the Pacific Northwest.
So that's why it makes sense. You're saying there's alternatives.
There's tons of alternatives. There's tons of transportation capacity here that doesn't exist anywhere else.
Wasn't there a study that either has been proposed or has been done on how traffic will slow if these arenas built?
There have been some studies done, but there's the memorandum of understanding specifically calls for a traffic and transportation study.
Does that start to address your concerns, Mark?
Because, clearly people take the bus down. I mean, the buses, coming off just Mercer Island are pretty packed on game days. And so unless there's going to be like a whole lot of extra service, I mean, I do remember at one point in time there were actually dedicated buses for, either Mariners or Seahawks events, and that seems to have dried up. And so we're now dependent on Sound Transit, which is just not enough. And so people are still going to drive. I assume there's going to be parking at these stadiums. And if there is, I dread the days that will occur, relatively, often throughout the year when we've got like two events occurring at the same time, which I'm sure will happen, especially if you've got five teams. And I'm not, you know, it just seems unfair to the people that, you know, aren't interested in the sports or, you know, aren't going to the games to have to put up with this, all this additional traffic when, you know, to be clear, I have nothing against, you know, getting a basketball team or a hockey team, but why we need to put it in the same area, it just seems like creating a lot of unnecessary contention for the transportation infrastructure.
By the way, just on that real quick, do you support the idea of looking at an alternative site as the SEPA says it's going to do on the east side?
The east side, I mean, you know, let's have the traffic going in the other direction.
All right, Mark, I appreciate that. Thank you. And a different subject to wrap this up. Christopher's in Wallingford. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, guys. Dow, always enjoy listening to you on KOW. Look forward to your future run for governor.
Have you made that announcement?
I have not.
Okay, just checking.
Quick question. What can you do to speed up the amount of time it takes King County elections to count ballots? It seems we're always waiting for King County to come in after an election, and it's a week, 10 days until we get final results.
Thank you for the question. You know, it used to be that it took quite a long time, and obviously in a county of 2 million, there are just going to be challenges with volume. But our elections workers went through a lean process where they all looked at how we process ballots, and they've been able to cut 40% out of the time that it had been taking us to count ballots, employee-driven improvements. That is the kind of approach we're taking throughout our departments to everything we do. And as we build out our capacity to implement this lean philosophy, we're saving money, we're saving time, we're improving customer service. And by the way, it also improves employee morale because they're being given responsibility, given authority, taken seriously, and they're remaking the way we do business. So I hope you'll see in this general election faster vote counting than you saw 4 years ago during the presidential election. And the thing about this improvement is that it's about continuous improvement. So we should be seeing better and better results as time goes on. But I thank you for the question.
All right. Well, we'll track you on that. Real quick question. The complaints about people when the ride-free area went away, there were complaints from people who said, look, where are the free tickets to the social service agencies? There was even a threat of shutting some homeless housing down and marching on the city mm-hmm. of Seattle. How are you going to get enough free tickets to the people who need them?
So we've filled every request that's been made this year
and still have more.
Through our formal process. Share, for example, the complaining party has received over $500,000 in tickets this year. And another 250,000 special allocation has been appropriated been approved that will go out immediately for bid from the various or for proposals from the various human service agencies, and another $2 million worth of free bus tickets that are going out on the street for 2013. So there is great capacity, and the difference is the free ride zone was this tiny area of downtown Seattle. With these tickets, we're talking about county-wide access for people of limited income.
All right, sir. We shall talk again.
It's been fun.
We'll see. We'll have some election results. We'll be able to see how the election did next time we talk to you.
I'm looking forward to it.
Dow Constantine is King County Executive. This is Weekday.
So when Steve was a little boy, he said, Daddy, what do you do for work? And Pops,
he took out a little piece of paper and he wrote, S-P-Y.
My dad's a spy.
On the next Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, we go deep undercover. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
And that comes your way Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Good morning, it's 10:43. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Northwest Ballet, presenting Nutcracker this December at McCaw Hall. With scenery by Maurice Sendak and choreography by Kent Stoll, Nutcracker features 200-plus performers, live orchestra, and a snowfall every performance. Information at pnb.org.
We have cloudy skies and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 54 degrees in the University District. Forecast calls for clouds later today with a chance of showers, the high reaching 63. Clouds and rain tonight, the low in the low 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
That's the theme of all the Charlie Brown specials. It's not radio, but Halloween has Katie Sewell thinking about Charlie Brown, who was not on the radio, on television.
No, he wasn't on the radio.
But you're thinking about voice acting.
Right. I was thinking about The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, because it airs every single year, and I've already watched it once this year, and I was wondering, whatever happened to those
You already watched it once this year?
Yeah.
It was on TV?
No, I rented it. Oh. But it is going to be on TV on Halloween.
Wow, she went out and rented it.
I know. It's pathetic. Wow. But it's been on the air every year since 1966. And I bet some people listening have actually probably seen it every single year since then. So anyway, I thought it would be fun to peek behind the scenes and find out some stories about how it was made and actually find out what happened to all the kids that were acting in it.
Well, because that was what was interesting about that. You know, radio actors often were not kids, or they were kids for a little bit and then they grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
in this case,
like we've talked about Dick Beals, who played children on the radio. But in this case,
so
these were actually
man.
Kids. These are all kids that acted these parts. And because these specials have been on for so many years, you really recognize their voices. So we know the cartoon Peanuts actually appeared in October 2nd, 1950 in 7 different papers. And today it's in over 2,000 papers and it's in 75 different countries. And the show actually has infiltrated our culture. We got the phrase security blanket from the Peanuts comic strip. And, of course, Good Grief from Charlie Brown is now part of our vernacular.
Made it popular.
Yeah. Yeah. It's we say those words because of that cartoon. And I think that's interesting. The Great Pumpkin aired in 1966 on CBS to incredibly high ratings. The Charlie Brown Christmas classic that came out the year before. And when it did, it came and broke all kinds of records. Nearly half of all the TVs in America were tuned in to watch when the Christmas special was on in 1965. So why not look at the Christmas special a couple months from now and pick the Halloween one instead? Well, partly because I like it better, but also because Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts, liked The Great Pumpkin better.
Each year, the Great Pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch that he thinks is the most sincere. He's got to pick this one. He's got to. I don't see how a pumpkin patch can be more sincere than this one. You can look all around and there's not a sign of hypocrisy. Nothing but sincerity as far as the eye can see.
Don't you love the idea of a sincere pumpkin patch?
Yes, I would like to go to a sincere pumpkin
patch. I know, I love it. It's such a weird criteria. So that's Linus, of course, in the pumpkin patch, waiting for the mythical Great Pumpkin to bring him toys. This cartoon, by the way, Steve, will actually still brings about 8 million viewers to it when it airs on primetime.
But it has never caught on with the idea of the Great Pumpkin bringing toys to kids.
No, it's never become something that actually happens. So anyway, so for a peek behind the scenes, let's look at the four main characters. First, of course, Charlie Brown, who is played by Peter Robbins.
Trick or treat. I got a popcorn ball.
I got a fudge ball.
I got a pack of gum.
I got a rock.
It was Charles Schulz's idea for Charlie Brown to get a rock. And the producer, Lee Mendelson, protested the idea. He's like, that is way too mean, you know, to just give him a rock every time he goes somewhere. But the more he protested, the more Schulz really wanted to do it. And in fact, because of all the protesting, he decided, if you think that's mean, let's have him get 3 rocks. And that's actually what happens.
That is cold. The show.
He never gets any candy. And so for years, viewers felt so sorry for Charlie that they would send candy to Schulz's studio every year, just to try to, you know, give it to Charlie, which I think probably worked out in his favor pretty well. So whatever happened...
He was a cartoon, by the way. Okay,
know,
go ahead.
I know. So whatever happened to Peter Robbins, who played Charlie?
I got an invitation to a Halloween party.
I had to play Charlie one more time. He dabbled in acting throughout his entire childhood, but as he became an adult, he decided to become a real estate manager in California. But he does say that playing Charlie helped him meet girls in high school. So I guess if you play a sympathetic loser growing up, everybody's like, oh, that's so sweet. I should take care of you. I couldn't find out very much at all about Kathy Steinberg, who was the actress who played Charlie's sister, Sally. She was the youngest of the group. She was really little during the time of the recording. But I do know she had trouble pronouncing a lot of the words that were written in the script. Like, toward the end of the cartoon, one of her lines is, I demand restitution, which she couldn't say. So when they recorded it, they had to do it in syllables. Restitution. So now that we know that, let's see if we can actually hear it.
What a fool I was. Trick-or-treats come only once a year. And I miss it by sitting in a pumpkin patch with a blockhead. You owe me restitution!
I'd like you to try to say that. That's what I was going to ask.
Restitution?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She
also was about to lose her front tooth when her parts were recorded. And so her mother called the producer, Lee Mendelson, in a panic, being like, her tooth is about to fall out tomorrow. And he said, oh, thanks so much for telling me. But her mother persisted, saying, no, you don't understand. She has a terrible lisp when she's missing one of her teeth. And so they rushed her into the studio that night in San Francisco to finish the recording, and her tooth fell out the very next morning. And the producer reports that you really couldn't understand a word she was saying once it did fall out. So anyway, that was Linus she was yelling at in that last clip, to which Linus replies.
I always thought Linus had a very musical voice.
That is the wrong clip. Radio 5? Oh, we're not going to get to hear Linus.
Well, tell you what. What happened to him?
Linus, unfortunately, well, he was acted throughout his entire childhood. But unfortunately, he died really young. He died 2 years ago at the age of 52. But he was the only one of the group that actually had a longstanding acting career when he was a kid, because people just loved his voice so much.
Here's this. We got an email from Carmen.
Okay.
He wrote, I grew up in L.A. and my friend Chris Shea in my third grade class at the time was a child actor, did the voice of Linus for Charlie Brown Christmas. He was definitely a real kid playing a real kid. And Carmen says they lost touch with him after high school.
Yeah, so now he knows.
Yeah.
He died at age 52 of natural causes. And then let's finish up with Lucy. Well, we have to do Lucy and Snoopy. So Lucy Von Pelt was Linus's older sister, and she was played by Sally Dreyer.
Say, Charlie Brown, I've got a football. How about practicing a few place kicks? I'll hold the ball, and you come running and kick it.
Oh, brother.
Oh, come on, Charlie Brown.
No.
I'll hold it steady.
Of course he goes for it, right?
He does? Every time?
Every time? Sally Dreyer went on to create interactive sculptures at her art studio down in Arizona. They describe her work as a collision between sculpture, architecture, and kaleidoscope. And that is a really good description of what she does.
You looked at them.
I did. It really is that. So if you want to see what kind of stuff she's making, Google Sally Dreyer and see it for yourself. It's pretty crazy stuff.
Dreyer.
Yeah. And we can't end without talking about Snoopy, because what do? When you picture Snoopy, you always picture him sitting on top of his doghouse pretending to be the pilot that's fighting the Red Baron. But the first time that Snoopy ever flew was actually in the TV special It's a Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. So Snoopy's voice, you hear him. You know, these specials were the first time he ever had a voice at all.
Sure.
And that was done. His voice was done by the director and the animator of the series, Bill Melendez. And so how they made his voice was he would make different noises. They would record them backwards. And then to give us that familiar Snoopy voice, they would speed that recording way up. So it's not only backwards, but it's super fast. So do you want to hear it one more time now that you know that?
Ah.
You can kind of tell it's backwards when you actually are listening for it.
You know, I think it's funny that you have this such a warm relationship with this TV special.
Well, it's been on my whole life. You know,
it's been the soundtrack of your growing up.
Yeah. So if I'm 35 and then there's people, you know, in their 40s, this has been on their whole life and it's going to probably be on until we all die. So we might as well get to know it better, right?
Yeah, that and Frosty the Snowman.
That's right. Well, maybe when we get around Christmas time, we'll look at
the career of Burl Ives.
With that terrible squealing nose.
Very funny. All right. That was good. That makes me hungry.
Oh, good.
Katie Sewell. And that's why we are going to think about lunch with Sarah Dickerman. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
Did you watch The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, as a child, or do you watch it with your children?
You know, I haven't watched it with my kids. Of course I watched it when I was
shame,
little.
For shame.
Well,
we didn't have very many choices when we were little.
Yeah, now you have so many. Well, all right. Well, now you know the background of, and the history of some of these child actors. You can watch with your kid and talk about, you know, how this guy became a real estate insurance salesman. Sarah Dickerman is a writer for Slate, for the New York Times. She also writes at sarahdickerman.com. She tells us about some interesting lunch places. What are you thinking about today?
I'm going to take you to Rione 13.
Rione 13.
Not particularly pronounced well, but it's a restaurant that's opened up on 15th Avenue, near my house, I might add. So it's convenient to me.
What do they serve?
It's named after the Trastevere part of Rome, which is sort of the slightly bohemian artist quarters across the river from the big monuments. It's an Ethan Stoll restaurant, one of his many restaurants, the young and entrepreneurial chef who's got some great restaurants around town. And it's Roman food interpreted through the Northwest lens, and so it's a lot of bright, garlicky, anchovy flavors, lots of mozzarella, served in different ways. They do little mozzarella platters. You can get it on pizza. And then some really great classics like the fried artichokes in the Jewish style, which is one of the classics of Italian cookery.
Now, I see that on the webpage where you can look at their lunch. What does that mean, artichoke fried in the Jewish style?
Well, because Jews couldn't cook with butter often if they were, you know, eating meat, they would became accomplished in cooking things with oil. And so that I think that's why it's called that. It would have been a tradition of the Jewish quarter.
Now, this is
in Rome.
This is on 15th and Capitol Hill, yes?
Yeah, and so specifically for lunch, one thing I like about it is that they do these nice sandwiches, quite hearty sandwiches. And they have one that's a great vegetarian sandwich called a chickpea fritter sandwich. Made with the chickpea fritters are not like falafel, but more almost like in polenta in texture with some cheese in it. And then it's layered with avocado, roasted tomato, and watercress or arugula.
Now, is this a sandwich? I'm sorry, finish. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's just a really tasty. I always have my eye out for a really tasty vegetarian sandwich, both because I like them, and, you know, I know that vegetarians sometimes, you know, have a harder time finding things without meat in them. So it's a nice choice there.
I see they have a sandwich that's smoked fish. So is there a sandwich that says Seattle at this place, or is it a sandwich that says Rome?
Well, I don't know how Roman I feel the chickpea fritter sandwich is. There's probably a tradition he's pulling upon that I don't quite know about, but it feels a little Seattle with the avocado thrown in there, I have to say. It's a nice classic West Coast touch on a vegetarian sandwich.
So that's I'll try. Rione, yeah. Rione 13.
Yeah.
How's
and it's
that?
Nice also, I took my in-laws there, and they're a little more, you know, traditional in their food tastes, and they just love the baked pasta. There's a baked semolina gnocchi that was really delicious.
Well, that sounds good.
And sauce and cheese, and very popular with them, too. So.
Sarah, I left you no time, so I'm just going to say it. Vintage Cakes by Julie Richardson, because you're making your son's birthday cake. That's the cookbook recommendation,
that's
huh?
That's right.
I like the idea of that. We'll have links to that. She says it's a retro book. Sarah Dickerman writes retro in terms of its style, not in terms of its excellent flavors. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, the New York Times, other publications. She writes at sarahdickerman.com. Rione 13 on 15th, a lunch recommendation. Sarah, thank you again.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening and joining us on Weekday. We will talk to you again tomorrow. Laurie Anderson is going to join us. We will also review the news of the week, and we will debate the marijuana legalization issue.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Girl Scouts of Western Washington, presenting Girl Fest, a day-long celebration for girls and their families, October 20th at CenturyLink Field Events Center, with hands-on activities, entertainment, and exhibits. Ticket information at girlscoutsww.org.
Will humans ever stop fighting wars once and for all?
If you go out and ask a bunch of random people that question, you're going to get...
No.
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 No. I just think that it's too ingrained in our human nature.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.